For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, let's give it up for Vote for Pedro.
Nice job.
I'm Mike Sullivan. I'm on staff here. I'm one of the organizers of the Xenos Summer Institute. And we're excited to have you out for the 18th annual Xenos Summer Institute. So welcome. It's great to have you guys. Now we're going to be focusing on explaining our hope, like it says in 1 Peter 3. Everybody should be able to make a defense for the hope that is in them. That's the focus of the conference. And to help us do that, we've got William Lane Craig tonight and tomorrow, Mark Middleburg Thursday, and all the way from Oxford, England, John Lennox. Now, we've been tracking our registration because we have to keep an eye on those things. We are, hands down, you are sitting at the largest summer institute we have ever hosted. And that's by hundreds of people. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that these three men on this topic are probably just some of the best three people we could have possibly gotten. If you want to learn how to explain your hope, these are the guys that can help you do it. So I hope you really enjoy your time with us. Now, we really need, even looking out now, I still see maybe 10% of this room has empty seats. Squeeze in, please. Lift the paper off the seat and just give your seat up. We need to make that, and that applies in all our venues. Please, no more seat holding. Also, if you're from our church, you really should pay attention to this especially. This whole event here is being simulcast in Building X up on the hill to the south of us, in the cafe right behind me, also in the Study Center auditorium down by the creek. All those venues are 3 minutes or less to get to. If you're from our church, throughout the conference, we would love to see most of you making your way to those other venues so that our guests from out of town can be right here in this room. So please consider that. There's also a spillover room on the second floor between this main auditorium and the cafe. Also, already talked about that. Food's good. If you have food out there, bring it on in. If you're out in the lobby, come on in. There's still a seat or two. Cell phones, though, are not good. There's nothing worse than in the middle of a great point, someone's ringer is going off. So please turn them off now or put them on silent. The speakers here today, all week, are prolific writers. They've written many, many books, and those books are all at the bookstore. In addition, we've asked them to recommend books on related topics that we think would really be helpful. Those books are at the bookstore, so please get out there and check it out. In addition to that, we've got a few authors here at Xenos. If you want a compelling, easy-to-read book for a non-Christian to check out, maybe a gift to give somebody that doesn't know the Lord, check out Dennis McCallum's book, Discovering God. It's over there at the bookstore. It's a fantastic book worth checking out. All right, now, let me get our pastor here up here to introduce him. Jeff, you want to come on up and introduce Jim? All right, this is Jeff Gordon.
All right, thanks, Mike. Welcome, everybody. I'm glad you're here. This is it's exciting for all of you to come, and we're just blessed to be part of this. And I get to introduce Jim Leffel. Jim's going to open the XSI this year, as he has on many occasions. This guy, Leffel, he was an aspiring hippie. When he came to know Christ, my wife said he still is a hippie. But he was at OSU as a student, and God rocked his world and showed him that he could use his gifts, his intellect, in ways that he'd never imagined. And after he finished his studies at OSU, he went on to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, where he received a master's in philosophy of religion. And one thing that really was a great privilege for Jim is that while there, he was mentored by Dr. William Lane Craig. And I know that he points to that as a very meaningful and formative time in his life. When Jim returned to Columbus, he taught philosophy here at various colleges, and then came on staff at Xenos full-time as on our pastoral staff. And he's had quite an impact. And God just continues to grow his ministry, as God seems to do to his faithful servants. And Jim pastors one of our ministry spheres. He teaches there on Sunday nights. He's one of our elders. He teaches classes here. He is deeply involved in missions. He is the spearhead, really, of our apologetics ministry that's become the Zenos Summer Institute. And in the realm of missions, I think there's a flame that the Lord seems to be fanning in Jim's heart that sort of ignited some church planting in Haiti. And Jim's also been on the ground floor of getting a work that we're involved with in Zenos in Ethiopia. Personally, God used this fellow in my life to help lay a theological foundation. He used to teach a seminar here for our leaders, and I feel indebted to Jim for what I learned and his investment in me over that time. So it's a great honor for me to introduce Jim, and he's going to take up the topic. Are you ready to explain the hope that's within you?
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, all right. Thanks for the welcome, and welcome all of you from all over the city of Columbus and around the country and Canada and Ireland and Thailand and now Taiwan. Some other places as well. It's just awesome to come together and spend these days interacting with contentful material. But I think the thing that really makes the Summer Institute work is the fact that we have all kinds of workshops and little sub-seminars and lots of little conversations that are taking place out there on the deck or over lunch someplace, and just the relationships that we establish and the dialogues that we are able to form. This is where the real fertile exchange of ideas takes place, and we are so thrilled that you're here. And just feel free to make yourself at home, make yourself comfortable here, get to know the people that you're sitting around, and your questions, your thoughts. This conference, especially this year, doesn't presume anything about your own faith. And I know that many people come out to sessions like this because you're exploring, and we really welcome your thoughts, your doubts, your criticisms, your concerns. And let's just make this a time where we are able to share and connect with one another, and to really be able to move forward with our mind intact, with a real authentic faith. I'd like to pray for us to that end, and then we'll get started on our first session. Lord, thank you so much for this opportunity to be together, to share in your Spirit as he leads us in the material that we're going to be covering here over these next few days, and just ask, Lord, that you would effect your perfect will in the lives and the hearts of the people that you have assembled, people coming from all kinds of places geographically and spiritually, that you would make yourself increasingly evident, and that we would have that sense of confidence that what we have come to believe is true indeed. So thank you for this time together, and just ask that you enable us to be attentive and able to digest the material here tonight. Amen. All right, so I was asked to teach on Are We Ready? Which I thought was a bad title for the first talk. Because if it's true that you're all ready, then it makes this conference, you know, irrelevant. And if you're not ready, then it just kind of rubs salt in the wound to bring that to your attention. So I'm going to go with a different topic, namely I'm going to talk about the God who speaks. I want to lay just a little foundation work for the speeches and seminars and stuff like that that you're going to find yourself faced with over these next few days. The text that we're working out of this week is 1 Peter 3, verse 15, where Peter says, "Set apart Christ as Lord in your hearts, always being ready to make a defense to everyone who asks to give you an account for the hope that is within you, yet with gentleness and reverence." And so this is where we get apologetics from. Apologetics comes from this word, make a defense, an apologia. It's a legal term. It means not simply to explain, but actually to argue the case. And this passage calls us to be ready to argue the case, that we have good reason to hope. And so just beginning here with this whole, what's the purpose of the argument? Peter says that we need to be able to provide a case for our hope that is within us. The Christian message is about hope. The Christian message is that there are answers to those probing human questions that we all, because we are human, must ask. Why do I matter? What happens to me when I die? What does it mean to live a good life? These are the kind of fundamental questions that everyone, because of our humanity, are asking. And so we can go from the perspective of human wisdom, and we can try to figure these things out on our own through philosophy, through various kinds of religious approaches. And we can kind of crawl our way through the dark to try to come to some answers there. But the hope that we have in the Scriptures is that God has revealed Himself to us and has brought to us personally the answer to those probing questions in the person of Jesus Christ. Our hope is not that we can somehow make ourselves better and in that way make ourselves acceptable to God, but rather the Christian message is about the gospel. It's about good news. Good news of what God has done for us in Christ. Not that we are able to work our way to God, earn His acceptance by just trying harder, being a little better, but by coming to God with the open hands of faith that says, I know myself well enough to know that I don't deserve the favor of a holy God. But I understand that you've dealt with that issue when you sent your Son into the world. When He took upon Himself in the cross the payment for all of humanity's rebellion against God, He paid for my sin as well. And the Bible is unequivocal if we approach God with that kind of humility to say, God, be merciful to me as a sinful person. We have the confidence based upon God's Word that He hears that plea and He counts the death of Christ to our account. Now, for a lot of us, that's just really good news. When you really begin to understand the depths of who you are outside of a relationship with God, to be forgiven by our Creator, the Master and Lord of the universe. No news could be better than that. And the early Christians from Gentile backgrounds and Jewish backgrounds, women and men, slave and free, were becoming revolutionized by this incredible message of the mercy and grace of God. And it was changing their lives. It was transforming their households. And their neighbors were looking in. And their neighbors began to see some changes going down. And they're beginning then to ask questions. What's up with you? I know you. Something's different in your life. Tell me what that's about. And this is where this passage then really comes to bear. That because we are the kind of people who, because we have God in our lives, are evidencing the reality of who God is, that is going to elicit interest and sometimes skeptical questions, cynicisms, doubts from others. And Peter says, be ready. Be ready to argue the case for this hope that is evident to even your neighbors growing up in your heart and in your community and in your household. And that is the challenge to all of us here today. What kind of challenge is it? It's a challenge that's rooted in our relationship with God. There's a spiritual motivation here. Set apart Christ as Lord in your heart. So our ability to make that defense is rooted in the fact that we realize that we have a sacred duty to honor God by explaining and engaging with the objections that people have to this Christian message. That's a part of the thing, that to honor Him and to lift His name up and to draw attention to Him means to be able to interact with the questions that emerge out of every culture about their misunderstandings and misgivings about who this God is. And then, of course, also, Peter brings out the fact that this defense needs to be prepared, it needs to be ready. For who? For everyone who asks you to give an account for this hope that is within you. And so, really, it's a part of how do we love other people. It's not just that we serve them, of course we do, and we meet their pressing needs in the name of Christ. We must do that. But that's not going to be enough because their needs are much deeper than any human being can ever meet, and we need to be able to present a reasonable case for the hope that is within them that only God is able to meet their most profound need to come alive spiritually and to be reconciled with their master. That's love. That's what love is the ability to argue that case with people who are lost and who are dying and who are facing a Christless eternity. We've got a message. And we have an opportunity that God has made available to us because He's changing our lives and people are taking notice. So that's the framework and the context for this passage that we're going to be studying here tonight. And I want to probe just a little bit deeper in this opening address. It's important for us to understand that Christianity, biblical faith, is pretty unique in this issue of persuasion. Other religions have spread, to be sure, and are missionary in orientation. Buddhist faith is this way, and Islam is this way. But the appeal to reason, the appeal to evidence, seems very much unique in biblical faith, and that God Himself, in the pages of the Old Testament, is always bringing to Israel's attention the case that He is arguing before the mountains, as it says in Micah. To remember the things that God has done, that God has a case, that God has an argument, that God persuades, that God has written in His Word the whole future of what the history of humanity is going to be and how He is going to involve Himself in it. There is a reason, there's a foundation for persuasion in this way. In biblical faith, it is simply absent in the faiths of the religions of the world. There's something fundamentally unique to our call to be ready to make this defense and to take up the argument to persuade, to make that case known. So our starting point here tonight is this, that God has spoken and that His speech, His word, His communication is the foundation for our persuasion. And I want to explore that in some detail here with you this evening, making a distinction between what is sometimes called special revelation and natural revelation. By special revelation, we say that God has made Himself known because, as it says in Hebrews 1, verses 1 and 2, that God, after He spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways in these last days, has spoken to us in His Son. So here is the God who speaks. He has spoken through the pages of Scripture, anticipating that one moment in time where the Word made flesh, God's ultimate speech, His Son. As John says in the introduction to his gospel, the Word is made flesh and dwells among us. That's special revelation. That's God intervening to affect the trajectory of history by Himself becoming a part of the story. We'll begin to talk about that at some length on Friday night and in some of our workshops as well. The focus of tonight, however, is going to be in natural revelation. God revealing Himself, speaking of who He is through nature. And so the familiar passage is Romans chapter 1, where Paul says, that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. By the very nature of who we are as human beings, there is intrinsically and inherently a knowledge of God, Paul says. And he goes on and says that since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. The evidence of nature is so compelling that it leaves people with an axe to grind before God. without an argument, without an excuse. God has made himself known through nature, and nature bears his fingerprints. And I want to just explore that a little bit here with you tonight under the thesis that God has created humans to know him and that he has left a trail of evidence that calls seekers to himself. And so let's explore this proposition right here and talk about the testimony of creation. The familiar passage, of course, is Genesis chapter 1, verses 2 and 3. The earth, Moses tells us, was formless and void. In the Hebrew, tohu wabohu, chaotic, lifeless. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of the waters. The Spirit of God moving always represents God's redemptive action in history, and it exists at the very beginning of the creation account, that in the creation days, that God is going to act for the good of a creation that is formless and void, that is chaotic and lifeless. And what does God do? His first action recorded in the Bible is his speech. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And so the formula of the creation account, God says it was and it was good. And so from the very beginning of the biblical narrative, we have a God who speaks. And his speech is so powerful that it makes that which is not something that is. Language and nature, an important biblical idea. Psalm 19, verses 1 and 2, I like it in the New Living Translation. It says, "The heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies declare the work of his hands. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night reveals knowledge." And so you see that connection of the psalmist between what God says, his speech, and the effect of speech, which is understanding, which is knowledge. Well, what we're saying is that nature can be understood and therefore can be a signpost to God because it reflects the ordered, rational structure that is unique to language. Let's explore that just a little bit. Francis Collins, who is the director of the National Institutes of Health, and before that was the director of the Human Genome Project, one of really the world's leading molecular geneticists and really leading scientists of our day, has written a book called The Language of God, in which he makes this point. He says, one can think of DNA as an instructional script, a software program sitting in the nucleus of the cell. Its decoding language has only four letters in its alphabet, A, C, T, G. A particular instruction, a gene, is made up of hundreds or thousands of letters of code. All the elaborate functions of the cell, even in as complex an organism as ourselves, have to be directed by the order of the letters in the script. It's not random. But like language, it's intentional and it's organized syntactically and semantically. Investigations of many organisms, he says, from bacteria to humans, reveal that this genetic code by which information is translated into protein is universal in all known organisms. And then he concludes, no Tower of Babel was allowed to be in the language of life. And so he's just is making this point that really is sort of an extrapolation from Genesis chapter 1, that God's speech brings into being what is, and that what is reflects this ordered nature of a rational mind speaking something into being. And this is something that not just Christians recognize, but thinkers and scientists who reflect on this from every philosophical or worldview persuasion. Steven Pinker, the Harvard linguist, has written a book called The Language Instinct, in which he makes this point. He says, many biologists have capitalized on the close parallel between the principles of grammatical combination and the principles of genetic combination. In the technical language of genetics, sequences of DNA are said to contain letters, and punctuation may be meaningless or synonymous or are transcribed and translated, even stored in libraries. He goes on, he says that the immunologist Niels Jerna entitled his Nobel Prize address, The Generative Grammar of the Immune System. What is Pinker saying? He's saying what everyone is saying, that when you look at life at its most basic level, it bears the order that is really only describable in terms of language. And that becomes very important because now we can say that we can be informed by nature because it is an information-rich system. It's not random. It's intentional, as all language is intentional. And for this reason, we can trust our observations of nature. We can draw real conclusions about nature because God, from the very beginning, spoke order into it. Must there be a systems engineer? We think so. And not just from the point of view of theists. Thomas Nagel, the NYU philosophy professor, probably the leading philosopher of our day in a secular context, has recently written a book called Mind and Cosmos, where he begins to interact with some of these kinds of questions. And he makes these points. He says, first, given what is known about the chemical basis of biology and of genetics, what is the likelihood that self-reproducing life forms should have come into existence spontaneously on the earth solely through the operation of the laws of physics and chemistry? And his point is that because life itself exists in way and cannot, defies all models of explanation for how life emerges from non-life, he thinks it's very unlikely that nature by itself could provide sufficient explanation for why life exists. And indeed, Collins picks up on this same point from the language of God. He says, how could a self-replicating, information-carrying molecule assemble spontaneously? DNA seems an utterly improbable molecule to have just happened, especially since DNA seems to possess no intrinsic means of copying itself. It's relying on RNA. And so for these reasons, the whole mechanism of life itself seemed to indicate that there must be something non-natural, indeed supernatural, that brings life out of non-life, just as Genesis 1 has said. Well, Nagel goes on. He says, second, what is the likelihood that as a result of physical accident, a sequence of viable genetic mutations should have occurred that was sufficient to permit natural selection to produce the organisms that actually exist, the incredibly complicated organisms like human beings? He's pointing out to the fact that there's no model that makes sense that these things would occur in some random fashion of molecules simply mutating, adapting to environment and so forth, and becoming increasingly complex over time, and complex to the level that an animal or indeed a human being is. It just defies probability to suggest such a thing. And so for this reason, there is a growing awareness across disciplines that the nature of nature is such that it is intrinsically content rich, information rich, intrinsically so, which begs this question: what about a systems engineer? Who arranged this incredible alphabet of life that we behold through the microscope, through the telescope? Now, secondly, and a little bit more along the lines of what I really want to explore here tonight, is the relationship between language, reason, and human experience. We're talking about this issue that God has spoken. God has spoken in nature, and he has spoken to the pinnacle of nature, which is human beings created in his image. That's what makes communication possible. Not only has God created a world that is intelligible and that is understandable, but he has created us with this unique capacity to make that connection, to make that understanding. And so, I want to make a couple points about this. One, dealing with language and adaptation versus language and understanding. What is the purpose of language is what we're asking here. And so, in following Thomas Nagel's reasoning, again, in Mind and Cosmos, he says the ability of creatures like us to arrive at truth or even to think about it requires an explanation. He says an important aspect of this explanation will be that we have acquired language and the possibilities of interpersonal communication, justification, and criticism that language makes possible. But the explanation of our ability to acquire and use language in these ways presents a problem of the same order, for language is one of the most important normatively governed faculties. To acquire a language is in part to acquire a system of concepts that enables us to understand reality. Now, what is Nagel saying? He's saying two things that are very important. What is presumed in language, first, is that language produces understanding, our capacity to reason, the ability of creatures like us, he says, to arrive at truth. That's a function of language. It's the ability to reason is a linguistic skill as well. Meaning, in his view, three things. First, that to use language to convey matters of truth requires first a conscious state of awareness versus merely a chemical reaction. And what he means by that is that to understand something rather than just to compute like a computer or something like that, to understand, to grasp the significance of something, requires consciousness, requires an awareness of the thing that the language is conceptualizing. And this seems to run at cross purposes with the idea that all human behaviors and activity, including our thought, are simply neurochemical responses in our brains. There must be something more to understanding than mere neurochemical reaction or response. Second, he points out that in understanding and in our ability to reason, deliberation is required. Deliberation is a skill that weighs evidence, that hears in one ear evidence for one claim and in the other ear evidence for its negation or a different kind of claim. Guilty or innocent? And what happens when a person needs to render their verdict? They go, as a jury would go, into a deliberation chamber, and they will argue among themselves through the evidence what was persuasive, what was not persuasive. They're weighing the strengths and weaknesses, the merits of the arguments with which they are presented by the lawyer for the prosecution, the lawyer for the defense. And at the end of the day, they are there on the basis of the rational merits of these sides are making a decision. They are choosing one verdict over another. And Nagel makes the point, as many others have as well, that the ability to act in this rational way, to arrive at rational conclusions, is something that only free beings can do. If we are, in other words, determined causally by our biology or by our environment or by whatever to arrive at a particular kind of conclusion, we are no longer involved in the reasoning process. And therefore, there must be something about a knower and a language user that is free and, in that sense, above the cause and effect workings even of their own neuroanatomy, even of their own brains. There must be some ability of free thought to arrive at true conclusions. And thirdly, he makes the point that in reasoning and in the use of language to convey reasoning, there is a very significant difference between perceiving the inference or the conclusion of a body of evidence or an argument and being driven by instinct. Animals are driven by instinct. That is the total explanation of animal behavior, that they are geared, they are hardwired to say arf, arf in the presence of another dog or whatever, and we don't have to ask, why is Fido behaving this way? We say, Fido's a dog. Instinct is what explains Fido's activity. But when human beings are acting, and when they are acting in relation to a body of evidence, and they are asking themselves, what is it in this body of evidence that suggests that we ought to reach a certain conclusion about it? And so there is an ability to just recognize the rational properties of a line of evidence or of an argument, and on the basis of that rational insight, to draw a conclusion. Instinct doesn't get us to that place. Instinct is hardwired to always move in a particular direction, regardless of what reasons might exist or not. And so for these reasons, Nagel makes a very revolutionary conclusion, revolutionary because he himself is an atheist, that nature alone simply cannot express what happens when human beings use language to convey ideas about truth, arguments, that there is something fundamentally non-natural in the biological sense going on in human beings that enable us to draw these conclusions. And then secondly, that when he says not only is it the ability of creatures to arrive at truth, but also even to think about it, to contemplate it, to be moved by the reflection on things that only rational minds and personal beings could really be excited about or interested in or contemplate in any way, that we are motivated by questions of truth, not just the need to adapt and to reproduce, but we're motivated to know and to understand, to explore. We're motivated by beauty and the need to express that. We operate in categories where we assess the merits of our own behavior and the behavior of others, and we call that good or evil, right or wrong, just or unjust. And then very importantly, language is that ability to really experience a love relationship. It's language that enables the private mind that I have to link with the private mind that you have, and to meet through the medium of language, and to express the deep thoughts of our hearts and of our minds, and helps us cultivate depth of relationship. None of these things would be possible without the effective use of language. And none of these aspects of language seem in any way consistent with a basically biological explanation of human life. And so contrary to the naturalistic view, language is not tied inherently to adaptation and to reproduction, but rather to understanding and to expression and things that only persons can do. Well, I think that's a very powerful point of view, especially, again, as it is coming from a person who does not have faith in a personal God like the God of the Bible, but who is recognizing just from an obvious understanding and observation of nature the way things must be if our own experience is to be made sense out of, to be explained. And lastly, the relationship between language and the mind. And here I think is a very important point that the developmental linguist Steven Pinker makes. He says in his lengthy studies of children as they learn to develop language, and there's a whole science that's involved with this. He says, a close-up examination of what it takes to put words together into ordinary sentences reveals that mental language mechanisms must have a complex design with many interacting parts. One now sees, he says, a common design in the machinery underlying the world's language. He calls it a universal grammar. He says, unless this basic design is built into the mechanism that learns, a particular grammar learning would be impossible. And just as language is an improbable feat requiring intricate mental software, the other accomplishments of mental life that we take for granted, like perceiving, reasoning, and acting, require their own well-engineered mental software. Just as there is a universal design to the computations of grammar, there is a universal design to the rest of the human mind. Flexibility in learned behavior requires innate constraints on the mind. The ability of children to generalize to an infinite number of potential sentences depends on their analyzing parental speech using a fixed set of mental categories. That's a lengthy and complicated quotation, isn't it? But there is something so amazing at stake in what this developmental linguist is saying. Based upon his research and the research of so many others, we are able to begin to draw conclusions about what it takes to even learn language and therefore be able to interact in ways that we described just a minute ago over matters of truth and over interpersonal communication, things of this nature. Now, what this man has argued, and many have just followed right along with him, is that there is something fundamentally unique about the human mind as a language learner. And what he is saying is that there is something, well, here's the language that he uses. It's amazing. He says, the mind is formatted to understand and to relate through language. The mind is formatted. We're not blank slates that come into the world. That there is something by virtue of who we are as human beings, according to this research and other kinds of research that back it up, that human beings by their very existence have certain innate capacities, rational capacities, and other kinds of capacities to make judgments about what's good and bad, for instance, things of that nature, that are not learned, but that are a part of what does it mean to be a human. And so fascinatingly, I think, Pinker, in his atheistic naturalism, in beholding the extraordinary development of a child grasping language, is forced to use language in his book like The mind is a fixed and innate set of mental categories. That there's something objectively true about the thinking of all human beings by virtue of their being human. That rationality is not just some sort of a cultural construct or some way that we've learned to interact with our environment, but that there's something basically innate in all human beings' ability to reason. It's transcultural, and it's throughout time. He speaks of the miracle of speech perception. Where does he get language like that? He speaks of well-engineered mental software. Doesn't a software require a software engineer, a programmer? He uses words like mind and design, all things that are fundamentally inconsistent with the naturalist hypothesis that all human behavior is simply a matter of environmental adaptation and the seeking of to reproduce. And so you see this incredibly complex situation going on, and that there's way more research involved with this that I think is important. Here's another piece of developmental language research. At the one-word level, the words learned most readily are those that refer to objects and events already well-established in what they're calling pre-linguistic intentionality. In other words, that there's thinking going on prior to language being learned. He says the word becomes attached as additional property, a kind of handle, to the already existing prototype in terms of which the object has been conceptualized. And so the conclusion is the fact that these words refer to things already known explains the startling rapidity of the growth of a child's vocabulary. Why do children learn language at such a remarkable rate and are able to combine uniquely words together in a virtually indefinite number of combinations to begin to express ideas? It is, according to this research, because those ideas already exist in the mind of the child, and the words are being used as a handle, as shorthand, as a way to connect their inner world with other people's world, and for communication in that sense to take place. It's a remarkable body of material, remarkable in its implications for what we are here together to discuss this week. Because what we are saying is that God has spoken. God has spoken through nature. There's a reason why language best expresses the operations of nature. It's because an intelligent God spoke the world into being, and the order and the symmetry, the complexity, and the understandability of nature is intrinsic to it because God built it into it. And God has created human beings in His image as language bearers, as ones who are able to further our understanding and our involvement in the world through the gift of language, through our ability to use words that tie ourselves to others, including Himself, which I guess brings us to the last point, which is that God has given to us this incredible gift of language, not only so that we could be connected in a real way to other human minds, but also, and most importantly, to Himself. And God created you to know Him. And He has given us all the capacities to learn and to draw inference about who God is and what is His intent through this great gift, the gift of language. So in conclusion, just coming back to the thesis that we started with, God created humans to know Him. That's why you exist. And God has put His fingerprints all over nature that evidence his reality, that it's not haphazard, that it's not random, that it's carefully constructed and is meaningful and intelligible. And he has left a trail of evidence that calls seekers to him. And so over these next few days, we're going to explore various aspects of God's world and God's word as they relate to his desire to reach out to his unique creatures made in his image to communicate not simply that he is there, but what his intent for us is, the intent to express his love and his purpose for each of our lives, because we, like nature, are the product of a carefully constructed design. We've been made for a purpose. And it is my great prayer and hope as we explore these ideas that increasingly your sense of confidence that God has made you to know him, that he has given you the powers, the capacity to reach out and to connect with him in a real way, led by language, and then moving in a deeper way, in an experiential way as well, to connect with the living God who is there. And God has made this entire communication system possible, from us as the subject, to nature as its object, to he as the creator and the designer. So that is the picture of the Bible. It is the picture of a God who speaks, a God who is not silent. It's a sweet picture. So why don't we just draw the line there, and we've got a little bit of time before we take our break. If you have a question or a comment, something that you'd like to put out there, why don't you raise your hand? We've got people with microphones, and they'll go around, and we'll have a little bit of a conversation before we go to break. And if you're in one of these other venues, sorry. Yeah.
Thanks, Jim. I had a question about those. I'm over here, in case you're wondering where I am. You're still
With the waving thing. Okay, there you go.
You know, they talk about communication skills of other animals and language of, like, dolphins and the songs of whales and things like that. How would you respond to language being something that's a gift from God for us and language within other species? Or would you even have to address
that? You know, that's a very complicated question. It's a great question. There's no evidence that we can see from those kinds of animal language experiments that the animal's language, if you want to call it that, is really for any purpose greater than adaptation or reproduction. And so the purpose of the language is something that has been brought into focus and into view. It has also been brought into view that these animal language experiments are very much the product also of fairly careful behavioral conditioning on the part of the researcher as they sort of manipulate the behavior of certain kinds of animals to express themselves in a certain kind of way. So there's a lot of debate. Linguists in particular tend to be extremely critical of these animal language parallels to human language. But I think that discussion is always going to be there because from the naturalistic point of view, they want to be able to show that what you see in human beings is in more primitive form also true in lower life forms. So what I would suggest to you is to look at books like Steven Pinker's The Language Instinct, which has a significant section where he interacts with this very question of, well, aren't computers thinking when they're computing and when they're doing their thing? Or aren't animals thinking when they're grunting and groaning and mooing and chirping and when we're able to manipulate their behaviors in certain kinds of ways? And I think he has a very good common sense analysis of this from a behavioral scientist's perspective. So there you go. Yeah.
So atheistic philosopher Jack Smart contends that teleological language as used by Pinker is merely heuristic. So could it be the case that Immanuel Kant is right in saying that our cognitive faculties just render the intelligibility in the world and there's nothing objective about it?
Okay, so you're saying that we use this language like design and like formatting and all this kind of stuff more or less as a metaphor because we as rational beings impose a sense of order or symmetry onto nature itself. This is the concern that you're raising. And I think that that's it's kind of a swing and a miss on that, because the reality is that when we are looking at the complexity, even on a molecular level, on a DNA level, we are not just projecting order onto a thing. We're actually able to describe a process, a mechanism in which information is in fact being transferred and which is organized in certain ways that if it was altered in a significant way, if the code, as it were, was different, that the result would be catastrophic. And so it's not just that we're seeing through certain kinds of rational lenses, that there is experimentation that is done. There are observations that are being made that suggest not randomness, but order, because nature behaves in a ordered way as opposed to a random way by the testing that's done. Who else has a thought, or are we good? In the back. God, speak up.
So his question is that God created the earth in 7 days, but what's the evidence for that?
Well, that's a little off topic, and I'll defer to Dr. Craig, who's going to talk about the cosmological argument. Actually, God didn't create in 7 days. He created in 6 days, and he rested on the seventh day. And in addition to that, there certainly is room in the reading of the Genesis text, especially in chapter 2, verse 4, where the day of creation kind of encompasses more than a 24-hour period. It's a lengthy window of time in which God creates. I think that commentators are virtually universal on this point. And so that's what I would say about that. But we can talk a little bit more about his day-age theory or literal six-day creation or whatever way to go. We can talk about that afterwards.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.